Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Seattle Nice. This is season two. I didn't even mention it last week. We're actually into season two. Erica, what do you think?
Wow, you're springing this on me. How exciting. What was our finale?
I don't even remember what the finale was. There's been no finale, but we just entered season right. two because that's what the calendar said. It was our 1 year anniversary. No cake, no celebration here. Sandeep, how are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, because we started, you're right, we started with the Sawant recall. That was our first Seattle Nice episode, was the Sawant recall. The results had come.
Sawant recall, yeah. So it was a December episode, and so last week was our season two, episode one. This is season two, episode two, actually. So anyway, this week, one of the things we're going to be talking about, surprisingly for us, a bit of departure. We're not talking about crime. We're not talking about homelessness, although it might come up. You never know. Twitter, Elon Musk having done some terrible, terrible things. Right, Erica?
Well, I mean, look, as we're recording this, you know, or between recording and putting this up, you know, who knows? There could be still more. But as we're recording this, last night and yesterday, he suspended the accounts of a bunch of journalists, a bunch of like prominent national journalists, suspended the account of his competitor, Mastodon, which a lot of folks are fleeing to, its competing social media site, and has really been promoting a lot of these sort of right-wing conspiracy theory accounts. I've been monitoring and posting on Twitter about, because I'm still there, about the stuff that gets pushed to me in my email inbox notifications. And it's kind of gone from a bunch of local accounts that I, you know, do and don't agree with, but, you know, local stuff to like Dinesh D'Souza, Trump, a bunch of sort of Taylor Lorenz derangement accounts.
Really?
And that's the
showing up in your feed.
Not in my feed, but in my email inbox. So I get like suggested tweets to go look at. And they are 100% right wing now, except for a couple of people that I actually follow. So it's gone from sort of relevant to irrelevant and stupid in like the blink of an eye. I mean, literally, like it's, you know, Dinesh D'Souza, you know, election fraud conspiracy theory bullshit. And so, man, it's just becoming less useful by the day.
United Nations now joining the European Union in condemning Twitter's decision to suspend some journalists who were supposedly like publishing his location or his flight location. I'm not entirely clear.
Oh, you mean that public data? Like, but a lot of them were not, for one thing, but
we're not, but that's what he claims. Yeah. That there certainly was one account that was tracking his airplane's location, and they're calling that part doxing. But the others weren't, is what I gather. I haven't really been following it that
not
carefully.
Doxing,
you,
by
Sandeep?
The way.
You mean if I say where your private jet is landing, that's not the same? Is that a partial doxing?
Well,
is that arguably doxing?
I mean, if you're talking about where his jet is.
Sandeep, tell us about your private jet.
Yeah, if I was tweeting about where the KUOW jet is at any given moment, I mean, that might be that might be a problem. But that's not what happened here with the suspension of the accounts of these journalists, right? They were being suspended for all sorts of bizarre reasons. And hey, guess what? Like, you know, I haven't been a Twitter fan for a while. I thought Twitter's content moderation decisions under the previous regime were often, you know, reactive, capricious, inconsistent, sometimes overly heavy-handed, and generally problematic. And guess what? Meet the new boss. You know, in some ways, same as the old boss, like Elon Musk now has the power to make these decisions, and he's doing arbitrary, capricious, overly heavy-handed moderation decisions based on rules that seem to be made up on the fly, you know? And so I think the problem here is that we have companies like Twitter that, on the one hand, they're private companies and they get to do whatever the fuck they want, right, with their content moderation decisions. On the other hand, they control or are the basis for an increasing chunk of what we might call the public sphere in America, the place where we have public dialogue. And obviously, when a small number of executives of whatever political stripes, whether you're Vijaya, you know, Gandhi or Elon Musk, and you have a kind of absolute authority over content moderation decisions, and they're done without transparency or any kind of due process, and people are getting booted or promoted, sometimes without any even being told about it. You know, I think there's a structural fucked up problem with that. And it doesn't matter to me in many ways who the boss is. I see problematic behaviors happening across the board.
Oh, come on, Sandeep. You cannot possibly say that it doesn't matter whether it's Elon Musk or the previous content moderation system, which I agree was not ideal, but they had one. Elon Musk fired all the people that are in charge of safety. And as someone who has been doxxed, harassed, threatened, and all kinds of bullshit thrown at me over the years on Twitter under the old content moderation system, it's already getting worse under the new system. So, you know, to say like that there's some kind of equivalence between, you know, not boosting, or between boosting Dinesh D'Souza and, you know, exposing people to massive amounts of harassment. I mean, the old system and the new system, like, yeah, neither was ideal. The new system is Elon Musk directly going in and banning accounts that he doesn't like and directly choosing to boost shit into, you know, people's feeds that is disinformation. And, you know, I mean, not for nothing, but, you know, when you say that they can do whatever the fuck they want, that's not really true. I mean, look at what happened to Facebook, you know, when they were allowing anything at all to be on their site and having no moderation. I mean, you can, you know, have, you know, revolutions happen, which, you know, can be good, can be bad, but, you know, you can also have people, you know, getting threatened with death threats. You can also have disinformation out there. You can also have terrorist organizations organizing, including domestic terrorist organizations that have real impacts in real life. So I think saying like it's just content moderation or it's just Twitter or it's just, you know, arbitrary and capricious, you got to look at like the impact of, you know, an international company, an international information company, and in the real world. And we haven't seen, I mean, Elon Musk has only been the head of Twitter for 2 months. Maybe he'll last two more, I don't know. But I mean, there have been profound changes already on the site that I think are really damaging beyond the shit that I'm complaining about, which is just annoying.
Let me just ask this, Erica, like, do you think, you know, on balance or Sandeep, Twitter's been a good thing for Seattle politics?
Mm-hmm. I think a good thing.
Let's hear more. Why? How so?
Well, I mean, you know, it's hard to talk about this without talking about how I think Twitter has been, on balance, a good thing overall. But in Seattle, I mean, I think that a lot of, I'll give one example. There's a journalist named Ryan Packer who writes about traffic deaths, and in recent weeks and months has been reporting on, you know, basically every single collision that they come across. You know, on the police scanner, I don't know their reporting techniques, but, you know, just saying this collision was a car running into a pedestrian. This collision was a car, you know, running into a bike. And that is the kind of reporting that really, really works well with a format like Twitter, where you're just kind of piling on information after information, and really creating like an awareness of this thing that's happening that's just much more effective than saying, you know, there were 30 deaths in Seattle last year due to traffic violence. I think that's been really good. I think, you know, for me, it's exposed me to a lot of different ideas, but also it's opened up sources. I mean, you know, my Twitter DMs are a real goldmine of sourcing, you know, people who follow me and see my work and, you know, want to give me tips. So I just think, despite the fact that Twitter can kind of feel like an echo chamber, both in Seattle and overall, it has exposed me to a lot of ideas and a lot of nuanced ideas that I, you know, maybe would not have encountered, and has changed my mind a lot on a lot of issues over the years. And I think that anything that can change a person's mind is a good thing. Now, caveats on that, obviously. There's a lot of disinformation out there, but Twitter is not a bubble. And it's made me aware of a lot of perspectives that I might not have encountered just going about my daily life. So that's the positive spin on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm not with you, man. I mean, look, if I could wave a magic wand and like ban Twitter or erase Twitter and social media, I would. I can't
just buy it.
Sell the private jet.
Well, yeah, we can. I'll make that decision while I'm flying on the KUOW jet. Yeah. So look, I mean, why do I hate Twitter? I mean, I guess I do think it's been a net negative, not just on our discourse in Seattle, but nationally. I think it's been social media. Yes, there's disinformation. That's a huge problem, but it's also, it channels people into, you know, kind of tribal groupthink. It allows people to kind of go and get their preconceptions ratified. So there's a whole series of problems, but here's sort of fundamentally, I come at this as a traditional lib, right? And I have that traditional lib sort of free speech perspective, right? Which is that the antidote to bad speech is more speech. But I will tell you, social media has tested that proposition for me, because the more speech argument worked a lot better when speech was much more naturally limited by, you know, the technological barriers that used to exist that in essence created sort of gatekeepers who took the raw voice of the public and kind of channeled them into, you know, a series of fairly wide but still limited range of sort of conflicting opinions. That gatekeeper function has been totally broken down by social media, right? And we have the radical democratization of information flow that social media has created. And so I'm not sure at all anymore that the cure for bad speech is more speech or whatever. But then you have a problem of how do you do, if this is the public sphere now, how do you do content moderation in a way that is consistent and fair and transparent and is not driven either by the caprice of individual rich people or by, you know, ideological biases? And that's a really difficult question that I don't think we're anywhere near to solving. And I don't think the old regime of Twitter did a good job. I mean, look, I think Elon Musk may well turn out to be a lot worse.
He already is a lot worse. That's the thing.
I don't know that yet. I will tell you,
he's suspending journalists because he has petty beefs with them.
Huge problem with the fact that they took down the Twitter feed of the fourth largest circulation newspaper in the United States of America 2 weeks before a presidential election. Unlike the knuckle draggers on the right, I don't think that affected the outcome of the presidential election. I think we were still talking about Hunter Biden's laptop and the fact that they took it down. And so I don't think that had any political.
Well, actually, people were probably talking more about it.
They might have been talking more about it. I don't think it had a political impact, but it has an impact for press freedom.
So we're getting off on a lot of tangents, and I want to go back to something you said about how gatekeepers are good, Sandeep. And this is actually why I really like Twitter for this exact reason. And I'll give you a couple of examples. So when you say gatekeepers, you know, you're talking about, I don't know, the New Yorker, the Nation, the KUOW deciding, you know, what is news and what isn't news. Publicola, sure. So so I would say one great example or a couple of great examples of why, what I mean when I say I was exposed to perspectives that I would not have been exposed to under the gatekeeper system. I have learned a ton about trans rights, and I have learned a ton about, you know, and I've met a ton of, you know, virtually met a ton of trans people and gotten their perspectives that I would not have gotten, particularly from the freaking New York Times, which seems to only publish articles about how trans people are destroying America. So that's one example. I mean, and there are, you know, racial conversations that I have been witness to that have changed my mind about a lot of things, or have rather opened my perspective and shifted my views on things that like, again, the sort of, you know, straight white male gatekeepers that you are, you know, saying should be in charge of everything would never have exposed me to. I mean, and so the thing about Twitter is, you know, you say it's like, you say it's a bubble, but I mean, if you follow enough people and you follow enough of a diversity of people, you actually will find that it is not a bubble. It is everybody. And, you know, I don't think anybody is going on Twitter and, you know, reading one person's tweet and thinking that's the only perspective on this issue that there is in the world. I think Twitter is great because you scroll through your feed and you get a whole lot of different opinions. And so let me finish. And so for me, That, I mean, Twitter really, like, truly, it has exposed me to a world of people that I would not have been exposed to through the traditional gatekeeping process. And I'm really, really grateful for that. And I worry that, like, in these new kind of bubble-lated social media outlets like Mastodon, that's going to go away because I'm just going to join a little, you know, whatever, Seattle urbanist group or a little, you know, journalist group, and I'm not going to be exposed to other people and other ideas.
Sandeep brought up the idea of the public sphere, which, as we all know, is a phrase originally coined by the German philosopher Jürgen Habermas.
Of course. I'm so glad that you said that before I did, David.
Exactly. And, you know, he was just basically talking about its importance to democracy, essentially. And he had another phrase called the ideal speech situation, which is a little bit complicated, but suffice to say, Twitter is probably not what Habermas had in mind when he was talking about an ideal speech yeah, situation.
One would hope not, yeah.
So here's the question, like, yes, we're getting exposed to many, many, many more ideas, but, you know, actually this podcast in some ways is closer to an ideal speech situation than Twitter, obviously. And so I guess the question becomes, like, is it actually good for democracy here in Seattle to have more Twitter, which are effectively like more superficial, truncated, kind of shitty conversations, potentially, you know, that also include the exposure to a diversity of ideas. So it's when Sandeep, you're talking about the gatekeeper function, aren't you basically talking about part of what gatekeepers do is create a better speech situation for democracy? And Twitter, just by definition, just kind of isn't that, because there's no editorial kind of decision making. It's a fucking free for all, and more of our democracy now is happening there, and therefore decision making is kind of impoverished. We're not actually talking through issues like homelessness and crime and the stuff we talk about on this podcast every week at all. It's just kind of like people farting out brief ideas. I mean, occasionally you get like a long thread that resembles like a longer thought, but just what about that part of it, Erica, where it's like, isn't it kind of a place for shitty speech to happen? It's great for generating, you know, clicks onto like Publicola and learning new ideas as a journalist. I use it that way as a tool too, but what about its effect on democracy? I mean, do you worry about that at all?
I mean, of course I worry about its effect on democracy. You know, obviously, Twitter has had a negative effects on democracy. But I think when you're asking about Seattle, I disagree that it's just shitty takes that are, you know, 280 characters. I mean, there's tons. Like, I will say I do a lot of reporting on Twitter that doesn't make it onto my website because I just don't have time, or I want to report about something in the moment. Like, here's a meeting that's going on, or here's my 5-tweet thread on this thing that happened. That's not going to happen anymore. And, you know, maybe that would be better stretched into a 1,000-word article, but probably not. And I will just say too, like, there, you know, the notion of citizen journalism, I think, is problematic to some extent because it's been expanded to include like sort of what you're talking about, anybody's shitty thought. But there's also a lot of citizen journalism going on out there. And, you know, there are some accounts locally that report on, for example, Office of Police Accountability, you know, reports that sort of dive into what cops are doing. And there are, you know, there are people on Twitter who are figuring out who those cops are and doing very detailed threads about them and about, you know, kind of putting their latest actions in context. And that's work that, like, frankly, I don't have time as one person to do. It's very useful to me. And I think there is a lot of good journalism happening just on Twitter that, you know, that isn't just driving clicks to the gatekeepers.
So if I could re-enter this conversation. So first of all, look.
Oh, for God's sake, Sandeep.
Yeah, let me be clear about this. There was a lot to criticize about the old gatekeeper model, right? The pre-social media model about how the media sort of channeled and directed information. And God knows I was a critic of it when I was writing, doing the media beat for The Stranger, right? Back in the day. And there's no doubt, to Erica's point, that there are good things that happen on social media on Twitter, and that you know, it does expose us to wider ranges of information. There's just a massive increase in information flow that's been enabled by social media. That said, I still think It's a big fucking net negative. And it's the reason it's a net negative is because by and large, Twitter does not act as a vehicle to kind of expand our universe of thinking. It largely acts as a vehicle for, you know, ratifying our preconceptions, right? I mean, that's what's happened is that social media sort of ends up channeling people because of the algorithms and because of human nature and whatever back towards sort of looking for those tidbits in this vast sea of information that tell them what they already want to hear, right? And that's the problem, not just with the public, but with journalists. Twitter is the place.
But that's true of traditional media too, Sandeep. Yeah. I mean, you read the New York Post or you read the New York
Times. It
was
better before. It was not that it was perfect before, but it was better than it is now.
I think it's a choice. And if you choose to live in a bubble, that is a choice you can make with or without Twitter.
The phrase I've used in the past is that, you know, Twitter has become this, you know, perpetual ideological circle jerk. Right.
That has not been my experience, despite the fact that you accuse me of, you know, believing everything that quote unquote Twitter left says.
I would strongly
encourage you to I'd be happy to show you who I follow and what my Twitter feed looks like.
Yeah.
Because it's that has not been my experience. Yeah. I don't follow disinformation accounts. Yeah. It's not my beat. I think it's a choice that was possible before and that people were making all the time to live inside little ideological bubbles. And I think that is irrespective of whether any social media site exists.
So given this Elon Musk thing, are you leaving Twitter?
Depends on what happens. I might, yeah.
Do you think there will be a mass exodus? Because this is pretty serious at this point.
It seems like Musk has to relent.
I think he will relent on this, and it'll be kind of like the cheapest Jack Dorsey thing about the New York Post. But who knows? I don't know. Maybe he will double down. I mean, too much power is being concentrated in the hands of the small groups of people that run these platforms, whoever they are, and too much power over information flow. And it's leading to arbitrary and bad results. And
I agree, but I think when you say whoever they are, like, we are looking at a current situation that is developing in very rapid real time with one particular person that didn't exist before. So
yeah,
let's be real. Like, we're talking about Elon. It is fucking
I do think this thing with the suspending of the journalist accounts is really sort of indefensible, even by the own standards that Elon Musk has put forward about. He wants to say he's a champion of free speech. And how the fuck can you go and do that? Right. Like, that's just nonsense. So if that's your idea of free speech, then you really are just a right-wing partisan, Elon Musk, and that's, you know, that's bad.
He also might drive it into the ground. I mean, that's the other possibility. I mean, he's taking out, you know, he's selling Tesla stock and, you know, and using obviously his own fortune to bolster the fact that advertisers do not want to be on this toxic site. And, you know, and so who
if
knows?
Twitter, right. If Twitter dies, I'll be fine. Right? I'm okay.
What would change? I mean, presumably, just some other site is going to replace it. I mean, what's the big deal?
This is Erica's point. There. If you're gonna do social media, there's probably a benefit to a place where. Look, I don't think everybody's on Twitter. I do think the world of Twitter is not reflective of the world of, you know, live reality. Yeah, yeah. That said, it is a place where, you know, there's some value in the place where people on the left go and people on the right go and people of this view and that view, and they're all to some extent interacting in the same social media space. I think that's valuable. If you go to Mastodon and all you do is, you know, you kind of jerk off ideologically with your, you know.
It could get worse.
Yeah, it could get worse.
The polarization
could get worse.
You know, I think when we had citizen journalism with the development of blogs, and I remember when I started in radio here in Seattle back in the early 2000s, fairly prominent talk show host saying to me that he didn't think blogs or the internet were really going to become a thing. at that time. But you know, blogs were citizen journalism. You've run blogs. You've worked on blogs. I mean, that's where the substance of a lot of your reporting happens. But what about just the fact that the tweets are so short? Is there any way to fix it? I mean, that's objection to it is there needs to be more substantive conversations, and they don't really happen on Twitter very effectively. It's trying to like have an argument. Imagine if we had this podcast, we were trying to text it to one another. It would be terrible.
I love having text arguments. I mean, as a writer, like I think Twitter is disciplining. I think it's made me a better writer because it is, you know, like a haiku format kind of, or a sonnet. I'm serious. I'm dead serious. I think it is good for writing. And I think it's very hard for me to imagine what will replace it. I agree with Sandeep. I mean, all these little, sites like Mastodon, and I haven't been on Post yet, but these would be competitors, they have the problem of like, it's not immediate because you're not broadcasting it to the world. You're narrowcasting it to your friends. And, you know, and as a journalist, Twitter has really helped me grow my audience. And I think develop kind of a public personality, for good or worse. And I'll miss that if it goes away. And, you know, and it could hurt, you know, driving traffic to my website. I mean, I'll have to figure out something. But, you know, I mean, I'll live, it'll be fine. But I will certainly miss certain aspects of Twitter. Now, what I won't miss is, you know, the harassment, the threats, the people posting photos of my house, that sort of stuff. Will not miss that. But, you know, that stuff will probably follow, you know, people to whatever format replaces Twitter.
Have you explored these other formats? Like, have you already been broadcasting? Find me on Mastodon. I mean, I just find that whole thing so ridiculous anyway. It's
so
like
so exhausting.
Well, it's not 100% clear to me what's going to happen here. Like, I guess my question is Twitter still going to be here a year from now in substantially the same form and occupying substantially the same space it currently occupies? I don't know. Maybe and maybe not, right? I mean, maybe it all falls apart and everybody leaves, or maybe people get over it. I mean, I remember a couple of years ago, there was a whole lot of public uproar over Facebook and how Facebook did moderation. And there was a thing where a whole bunch of my friends all migrated to MeWe. We were all going to go, and I opened a MeWe account, right? Like, and there was this whole like, yeah, fuck Facebook. We're all going to go to MeWe and it's going to be much better. And they're like, you know, virtuous. And that lasted about, you know, about 6 weeks. And then everybody's back on Facebook, you know, like the whole, I haven't gone to MeWe in like 2 years, right? If, you know, so I don't know, right? Does Elon Musk fix this major fuck up he just made, and then everybody forgets about it a month from now, and you know, he kind of calms down a little bit, or does he drive it into the ground? I don't know. I think it's an open question where this is going to end up.
Can I press you both one more time? Just to ask one more time, like specifically, and I don't know the answer to this. I don't have even an opinion about it really. But would we be having better conversations about solving our public housing crisis, like addressing all the, you know, problems that lead to homelessness, if social media didn't exist, if Twitter didn't exist, were we having better conversations before Twitter?
I think through the
extent, as a city, when it comes to governance,
it's not just Twitter, but the whole social media. But to the extent that social media has helped drive sort of polarization and division in the city, which I think it has in our politics, then I think it makes it harder to like come together and find solutions on stuff. And I think it's hard to get stuff done unless you can kind of talk across divides. Even in a city like Seattle, we have pretty deep political divides. This whole podcast is about that, right? And so if you can't find ways to talk across those divides and find common ground, and it's hard to, it's just, it, we're evenly divided enough that it's very, that while both sides dream of some ideological nirvana where they run the world, like mostly they got to figure out how to work together, right? If they're going to do anything. Otherwise you could just kind of retreat to your bunkers and, you know, throw grenades at each other. And right, I think that's sort of what social media largely promotes, not always, but largely.
Well, I mean, I think listening to your response, Sandeep, I mean, I don't disagree that polarization has increased in the city of Seattle, but I will point back to, you know, just trying to remember a time before Twitter, which I really can't. but I think back to, like, you know, when Shama Sawant would have, 200 people show up in red shirts to city council meetings. Now, maybe some of that was organized on Twitter, but I mean, that is like a real world situation that you're talking about where it is incredibly polarized. You know, it sort of made city council meetings about that and not about these, you know, wonderful deep discussions that, you know, supposedly used to happen before Twitter. And so I just think that the polarization was happening already, and it would have continued to happen in some form or fashion without Twitter. And I also think it's kind of meaningless. It's as meaningless to talk about pre-social media as it is to talk about whether things were better before the internet. I mean, there are some things I think were better before the internet, right? But who cares? I mean, we're in a situation, a world now where everything is going to get hashed out online somehow.
I agree with that. I agree.
I'll just point out that David Brewster would probably say, Town Hall founder and Seattle Weekly founder, would probably say that your days at The Stranger, pre-Twitter, pre-social media, was that pre-social media? Not quite pre-social media, but we're all about driving.
Oh, it's pre-social media.
We're all about driving polarization, all about, and not always about having the most rational conversations.
Look,
about
again,
topics.
there's no golden era where everything was perfect. This is all a conversation about, you know, relative good versus relative bad.
I will say, in the David Brewster days of Seattle Weekly, you know, when they said, oh, we've got to charge something for this to show that it has value. And, you know, and I worked at Seattle Weekly too. And there's a lot of shit that we wouldn't cover because it wasn't considered, you know, our demographic. And I don't want those days back. I think those days were bullshit. And frankly, I think, you know, in our day at The Stranger, and I was there from 2003 to 2009, I mean, we were not really driving polarization. We were driving a point of view and, you know, and maybe in sort of gonzo ways. But I mean, that's not polarization. That's just saying, like, look, this is our perspective and we own it. And I think that kind of, you know, nose in the air gatekeeping crap that, you know, the sort of high and mighty old school Seattle crowd supported and did. It was not a better world.
Right.
You know,
and those people
ago.
Sometimes, yeah, sometimes the gates were too locked and too tight and it was too restrictive. And there were issues with that. And we criticized it. Look, I will just make a quick defense of our era of The Stranger. Like, I thought The Stranger was a lot better when we were there. Like,
we did a lot of
good, interesting work. I thought, you know, not everything in The Stranger was good. And yes, did we pick fights and stuff like that sometimes, but we also moved the ball forward on some stuff and did. I thought that was an era when The Stranger was really kind of coming into its own and doing good journalism on the news side. So anyway, that's me kind of blowing our collective horn, but I'm gonna do that because I think it's true. I'm a bit saddened by what The Stranger has become, which I think The Stranger in some ways is kind of an extension of Twitter nowadays, right? Like The Stranger as it currently exists is sort of a creature of the world that social media has created. And it's much more about the kind of hot take activism part and much less about the journalism part. Even though we were advocacy journalists back then, we took the journalism part more seriously, I think.
Sandeep, I'm going to shock you by agreeing with you. I mean, I don't know what The Stranger's readership is anymore, or if, like, you know, young people have even, you know, heard of it, but it does. It does feel like sort of a reaction to the conversations that are happening. And maybe that just has to do with, you know, the kind of talent they can get and, you know, and what they're paying people. And I mean, it's a much smaller organization and blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, the media has changed in Seattle and I think Twitter has influenced that. I mean, it's influenced my coverage too, frankly.
Look, one of the things that Twitter was trying to grapple with was actually the rise in political violence that in part is provoked by some of the shit that's being said on social media, on places like Twitter on the right, you know. And there's just a case this week of this guy, Mark Leonetti, being prosecuted by the Department of Justice for having sent like hundreds of horrible, like racist, anti-Semitic, threatening, truly disturbing, graphic descriptions of murdering public officials, you know, members of Congress, senators and congresspeople. And I don't know what Mark Leonetti was doing in his spare time, but probably like absorbing all of this like horrific misinformation, you know, and so that part of the world, I think, is definitely worse. We all agree about that. And it seems like, Sandeep, in your desire to want to defend the kind of free speech liberalism, you know, that maybe made more sense like 20, 30 years ago, just that part of it is really, truly unsettling. You know,
where this is headed
under Musk next year, heading into the 2024 election. Right. It's like being that old school ACLUer type seems a lot harder nowadays, given that, look, the guy that attacked Nancy Pelosi's husband, right? Like, where do you think people are getting this shit? It's obvious.
Yeah. And this is where I have come around to a view that there needs to be some level of gatekeeping, or you have exactly the kinds of situations developing that you're talking about here. And what is content moderation, right? When Twitter or Facebook or whatever say we're going to have these content moderation regimes, that is essentially an attempt to create a gatekeeper function for social media, right? There now, the question is, you got to do that right. And I don't think they're doing it right. I don't think that, you know, if you're going to intervene into the public sphere and these conversations are happening on social media and elevate some people or mute others or kick people off or ban people, or there needs to be some clearly understood, what are the rules? They need to be applied consistently. They need to be and transparently. And there ought to be some kind of due process, right? Like so that Elon Musk can't just, you know, have a bad, you know, get pissed off one day and kick 8 journalists off Twitter, like forever, right? Like that. That's fucked up. And I will go back and they shouldn't be like, because like, you know, the Twitter executives of the old regime were freaked out about Trump maybe getting reelected, like shutting down the New York Post for a few days. Like that's wrong too. So what that kind of fair and transparent and consistent process looks like, I think is something that there needs to be more discussion about, because I don't think we can trust either the government to do it or the platforms to do it individually. So there's got to be some kind of hybrid.
But sorry to take this back to that, but I mean, Erica made the point, shutting down the New York Post because you had some, you know, what turned out to be, in retrospect, not necessarily exactly right reasons for wanting to suppress that article.
Well, but and to be clear, they said it was because it was hacked materials, not because they were freaked out about Trump. Now, you can have your interpretation and say that wasn't true, but
they weren't. They weren't actually. We now know they weren't.
No, that's a fair point. And actually,
they were not hacked materials, though, right?
I thought the Twitter I thought the Twitter files stuff, where the build up to it was, we're going to have this big reveal about how ideologically biased Twitter was. I thought that was a huge dud. Like, I did not see in those conversations about the New York Post story anything that made me think that they were. It's a fair point, Erica, that they were doing it for.
It was a Giuliani plant of a stolen laptop. I mean, you know, the whole story, you know, has problematic origins to begin with.
Who cares? Who cares where the, you know, I mean,
there was also it was a nude photo of Hunter Biden taken without his consent.
Like Hunter Biden, you know, engaged in some, you know, pretty salacious, like, you know, sex and drugs, you know, things, and, you know, and he traded on his dad's name to make bucks, and that's kind of you know, not very you know, not very seemly, but so what? Nobody fucking voted for you know, I mean, it's not like Trump's kids aren't, you know, huge beneficiaries of, you know, egregious nepotism either, right? Like so I don't think it was a big the stuff I hear from the right about how, oh, this changed the outcome of the election and stuff like that is just complete horseshit.
I mean, the other thing is, like, take it to the New York Times in the build up to the war in Iraq. Talk about misinformation, basically publishing, you know, completely false information by whatever that guy's name was, Chalabi, right? Leading into the war in Iraq. I mean, should Twitter have banned the New York Times subsequently for ever using anonymous sources, given how irresponsibly they used?
I mean, they asked the Post to take the tweet down. Back in the days of Dorsey, you know, people would talk about how they got banned until they took a tweet down. And that was what was requested of the New York Post. And I'm not taking a side on this, but I do think the facts are relevant. It's not just like, you're banned forever, goodbye. It was like, can you please take this tweet down and then we'll reinstate you. Now, was that the right decision? You know, I don't know. But let's not mischaracterize it as like just banning the New York Post forever, banning the New York Times forever.
They said no, we have a legit story here and we're not taking our tweet down about the story. And I, you know, again, I think they're a major American newspaper, whatever you think of them or their view. And I do think there are press freedom implications.
Sure, but I think you can find one example for that, and then you can find like in years of Jack Dorsey being in charge, and then in just a couple of days of Elon Musk being in charge, it's just this flood of bans. So I think there's some false equivalence going on.
Yeah, exactly. And Sandeep, I mean, do you actually think it's right to compare, you know, banning the New York Post for a few days or whatever to banning white supremacists who are explicitly promoting the kind of violence that you know? Is actually being acted upon. I mean, are those things, it's not even morally equivalent. It just seems like the reasoning behind it comes from a completely different place. In both instances, it's efforts to try to curtail dangerous misinformation. And it's hard to do, but like, isn't that part of the gatekeeping function of Twitter potentially?
Of course it is. And look, I have not yet, and maybe this is happening and I don't see it. I'm a little skeptical of a lot of the hyperventilations I see from the left about Musk and some of the stuff that he's done. He has restored a lot of accounts. Is he allowing people to just go on there and threaten violence and stuff like that? If he's doing that and that becomes the new regime, I do think that's terrible and Twitter should go away and we should all abandon it if that's what's
going to happen. But people are talking about how Musk is reinstating actual Nazis and pointing this out like Stormfront and what I hear from a lot of the kind of, you know, oh, let's just calm down crowd, you know, like you, Sandeep, is well, you know, I don't know. It doesn't seem, we got to wait and see. And, you know, I mean, does it take somebody like being dead directly because of Twitter? Does it take like someone's house getting firebombed? Does it take, you know, Nazi rallies in the streets of Seattle? Like at what point will it be convincing?
One of my first formative political experiences as a kid was the ACLU defending the Nazis' right to march in Skokie, Illinois, right? That was one of the first major political controversies that penetrated my consciousness as a young person. And I was very, very much on the ACLU side of that. I thought it was incredibly important and brave what the ACLU did. And that sort of shaped my – Nat Hentoff, who used to write for the Village Voice and his column used to get reprinted in the Washington Post and was a sort of classic traditional free speech defender and advocate. And I loved the old ACLU. The ACLU is not that anymore. The ACLU is now kind of Erica Barnett, you know, with a lot of money. But but that old ACLU free speech thing is something.
I mean, I think the ACLU does good and relevant work, and I think sometimes they are free speech absolutists to an extent that, you know, that actually has real world results that are really troubling.
I don't think they are free speech absolutely.
And also, I mean, I think people who cite their opinions when they were 12 years old or whatever are kind of an example of why I think gatekeepers are bad and you should be exposed to new ideas. There's a strong
and longstanding liberal tradition around free speech that in the last few years has become upended as the left has weirdly, it's now become a kind of right wing thing to use free speech as a cudgel. And the left is all about sort of, you know, constraining ideological opinions, of extreme ones, granted.
Ideological opinions, like believing that
the Jews will not replace us. We should shut up those bad people. Yeah, there's a lot of that on the left, you know, and even though
you know, the Nazis have a constitutional right to march in Seattle, Elon Musk, or I don't know if they do. I think they do, right? But Elon Musk doesn't. In fact, they have a political right in Seattle, but Elon Musk doesn't have to let the Nazis march on Twitter.
This goes back to my original point that these platforms are simultaneously both private entities and important public spaces.
So how we feel about that is ought to be similar.
Well, I think it's a little trite in 2022 to say, wow, the ACLU in the 60s did this thing that I was really, you know, 70s, excited about.
70s, please. 70s, don't make me that old.
In context,
not, Erica, not that long after World War II is the point.
Well, that's true. That is true. But my point is, like, we live in a world now that has Twitter, and in which Twitter, you know, in which you can organize these kinds of events on Twitter, and in which people actually then die. So we're talking about rallies in which people are being, you know, mowed down by vehicles, in which people are being radicalized on Twitter, you know, and in other spaces to believe that, you know, that some life is not, you know, is not as valuable as other lives. And so, you know, it has real world consequences when you say it's fine for Nazis to rally
it
on Twitter.
It did then too, though. It did then too.
But I do think to your point,
and that's why I think we shouldn't go back to our opinions when we were 12, because I had a lot of opinions when I was 12.
But the argument at the time was
have now.
Yeah.
That the solution to bad speech
was
more
speech. I know.
Better
speech. More speech and better speech.
Now is speech is so impoverished that may not be the case.
The problem now is that social media is showing that that's probably not true, right? Because the more speech tends to be worse speech than the one.
Right.
Because of social media. Right. Because the preponderance of the speech tends to be bad, right?
I actually tend to disagree that, you know, that a Nazi march is necessarily just speech. And I'll give a more immediate example that's happening now. I mean, there are Nazi marches happening now too, but, like, for example, people at abortion clinics or just at Planned Parenthoods that they believe provide abortions, you know, are shouting down women, attacking them and not letting them enter. And, you know, would the ACLU argue that that is speech? You know, possibly. I just personally happen to disagree that, interfering in people's right to go into, you know, a place of public accommodation is speech. I think that there's a little more nuance to it. And I don't think that position is as profound as you guys seem to think it is.
I'm not taking a position about that example. I think that these things have been adjudicated, and when there were situations where people were, you know, literally blocking people's access or yelling, you know, that there have been legal accommodations made that force those people to not restrict people's ability to, you know, access perfectly legal services. And so you can stand there and protest and yell if you want, but you can't, you know, threaten people or you know, curtail their ability to, you know,
literally happens all the time.
I know, but it's a body of case law about this, right? That you know, has tried to find that balance.
My point is people are getting threatened on Twitter.
I think, as I said at the beginning of this, I may have started out a kind of old school free speech absolutist, but I think the example of social media has taught me, again, coming back to it, that we do need some form of content moderation, which is about gatekeeping, right? There needs to be some level of gatekeeping. And the question now is, like, how do we construct those gates, right? How does that happen? What does that look like? Who makes those decisions? How do we make sure that the gates are being constructed in a way that's not arbitrary or capricious or unfair or biased or, you know, reactive or, you know, blah, 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 right? Like, that's the big question that I think we face as a society around social media and around speech.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think that the solutions will always be imperfect because we're talking about, you know, trying to control the activities of billions of people potentially. So
yeah, there's no perfect answer, but we can do better. I mean, I think we agree that it kind of sucks right now. like that it's pretty shitty. I mean, maybe we disagree about whether I thought it was pretty shitty before, and maybe it's worse now. I don't know. I don't know for sure yet. But
shitty before and worse now is actually probably a pretty good place to end, because I agree with you completely. Shitty before and worse now.
That's not just speech. That's politics. That's everything. That's Seattle. Seattle, shitty before and worse now.
Just put Habermas in charge.
That would solve it.
All right.
Mad Max Weber so is my main man. Weber.
Oh, he's dead, Habermas. Though. Habermas still alive. Well, that's it for another amazing edition of Seattle Nice. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to communicate with us, we're on Twitter. It's at Real Seattle Nice at Twitter. He's Sandeep Kaushik. She's Erica Barnett. I'm David Hyde. Happy December.